This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hey folks, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Not sure where you're at in the U.S. or around the world, but I want to thank you and for joining Baseball Outside the Box. This is the show that loves to interview baseball's best coaching minds who love the challenge, the status quo. And thank you so much for joining. And today, we're not wasting any time because we have one of the best college baseball coaches in the country. Well, if college baseball was all over the world, he might be one of the best in the world. But I do want to thank everybody. And before we start, I did want to mention, please go to YouTube. Peter Caliendo, subscribe, and also our podcast. That's where the audio goes on. Go to Peter Caliendo. Go to baseballoutsidethebox.com for the audio. Really thank everybody around the world, over 100 countries. We got people listening in, so we really appreciate it. So let me welcome, forget reading the bio because it takes too long, but think about it. Three-time National Coach of the Year, 8 conferences Coach of the Year, 5 times he went to Omaha. I mean, you know, and I know he's going to tell you that's great, but you know, there's a lot of people that have helped them out along the ways. Let me welcome TCU head coach Jim Schlossnagel. Jim, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Peter. I'm fired up for this.
Hey, I got to tell you, I can't tell you how many times I said your last name and I still messed it up.
You know, you're the first guy in 50 years to ever do it.
Hey, I got to ask you, since we're on it, because I'm always curious because we're talking about around the world. Schlossnagel, nationality?
German.
German, also.
Oh, yeah. Schloss meaning castle, Nagel meaning nail. So I'm not sure exactly what that combo is supposed to be, but who knows?
Well, we got a lot of good friends from Germany, great baseball country. Tom O'Connell, one of the board members with the ABCA, you know, does a lot of work in Germany with ISG. Plus, you know, Greg Frady was the former national team coach in Germany. I know the Germans will be listening. I love it. Listen, let's not waste any time because I know you're extremely busy, but let's just get into, you know, I guess the common question would be, you know, college baseball, where's it at right now? What have you been doing during the virus with your players, coaches, recruiting, all that kind of stuff? What's that look like now?
Well, it certainly it got shut down, you know, on March 11th, I believe, is when we landed. We had just finished playing out in Southern California, and within 72 hours, our season was over, and really nothing went on from that point. All the way through the summer, we're still in a dead period from a recruiting standpoint, and that's scheduled to last until April 15th. It hasn't slowed down recruiting. It's just a different form. Obviously, a lot of online, a lot of watching simulcast type games and Twitter stuff, and you know, we're committing players that have never been on our campus and that we've never met it literally in person. So how could that possibly go wrong? It's just, you know, there's going to be ramifications of that for, excuse me, many years to come. Our guys got to play a little bit of summer baseball down in Texas. In our part of the country, things are a little more open and have been for the most part. And then once they got back to campus, our fall practice actually went off great. You know, with the exception of, you know, everybody having a mask or a gaiter around their neck, and us not using our locker room to fully, you know, get dressed and undressed. We just used it to run in, grab your glove or your bat and run out. Everything else was very, very normal. And our guys did a nice job. I think we have three or four positives throughout the entire fall. Which isn't that big of a deal. It's the contact tracing that really knocks you down, but we never had to stop our practices. We were able to have two full inter-squad teams. Of course, this year in college baseball, they gave, as you probably know, they gave everybody an extra year of eligibility last year and gave us some scholarship relief for those seniors that wanted to come back. we're allowed to have an unlimited roster. So normally we have a roster of no more than 35, And now it varies from team to team. Some still have 35, some have 50. You know, we're currently sitting at about 44, and we have 8 seniors on our team. 5 of those guys are in their 6th year of college, which I think is an absolutely beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But we, you know, our fall practice went off great, and now we're just trying to get through the holidays and the normal anxious time of, you know, hoping and praying that our players are doing the things they're supposed to be doing away from us to A, stay healthy, and B, you know, get prepared for the season. No one has told us, at least in the Big 12, in our conference and in the state of Texas, that we're not going to start on time. Mm-hmm. So we're planning on February 19th, you know, our first game, and we'll go from there. And if we have to adjust, we will.
Coach, you know, and I'm glad you brought that up. People know about, you know, what the season possibly could look like. But, you know, at the same time, we know we don't have a crystal ball. Anything could change. But, you know, good thing, but, you know, vaccines are coming. I think that'll be a great help. I know, you know, even with Major League Baseball, you know, they followed some protocols. Things went well. So I'm sure college can do the same thing. Here's an interesting question, because I always ask this to coaches during this time of the virus, you know, advice to, you know, at high school, college, and even guys internationally, advice to online, some of the things that they could be doing with their players, or some of the things maybe you did or your coaches have done with your players to kind of keep them sharp, educated, motivated, you know, all those kind of words. What's something out there that coaches can do?
Well, first of all, for themselves, I mean, I'm a big believer in, you know, all, you know, being a lifelong learner. So, you know, the one thing that this virus has given us that we don't normally get is extra time or more free time, or, you know, time that you can spend positively or negatively. And so the American Baseball Coaches Association, ABCA's website, is a great resource to go on there and watch, you know, videos from past conventions if you're a member. And, you know, you can see, you know, practice plans. You can, if you're wanting to learn some things about pitching or base running or infield play, you can go do that. And you can share those with your team. But in college baseball, you know, we're very limited by the NCAA in terms of what we're allowed to do. So there have been times when we're able to do some baseball type instruction, or we spend more of our time on team building and working on the mental game and our routines that I think are so important. We've actually had a Zoom call with our team every Tuesday for about the last 4 months, and we'll continue that through the holidays. Even when we were in class and in practice, we continued to do that. So I think, like, you know, just like you're doing, like, we're all going to come out of this with it's certainly overall in my mind been a negative, but there's going to be positives that come out of it. You know, holy cow, this is a more efficient way to do this, or a better way to do that. And so I would encourage coaches to use the mediums that they have to provide, you know, some instruction, show them a concept, show a video of that. You can pull things off MLB's website to show things that are done well or things that aren't done well. You know, I treat it like a classroom, and, you know, we give, you know, tests, for example, and you can have some fun with it, with some contests and prizes and stuff like that. But, you know, you just have to adjust, and it's not ideal. But I think any opportunity to interact with your team is a good opportunity.
You know, you mentioned two words there. One was adjust, and the other one, you were talking, you know, I know you've talked a lot. I've listened to you quite a bit, you know, and even with Brian Kane about the mental game. I want to get into that a little bit. But before we do, stick with the recruiting part, because let's say the virus is not there. How has recruiting changed for college baseball compared to when I played? It was a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm 50 years old. This is my 30th year of college coaching. I started even as a student assistant in college. It certainly has changed a lot. In my personal opinion, none of it for the better. You know, just probably 15 years ago, 10 years ago, even, the recruiting cycle occurred, in mainly the evaluation and interaction period began in the summer prior to a player's senior year of high school. We would go watch the guy play all summer. If I'm watching a team that had young players on it and I saw a really good sophomore or a really good junior. I certainly never went to watch a freshman play or even younger than that. But I would, you know, just make a note, hey, we'll follow this guy. We'll look him up next year, stay in touch, you know, follow his progress somehow. But all of your evaluation and your interaction was with a guy before his senior year of high school, the summer and fall before his senior year. And a lot of times, some of the very best players that I was ever a part of signing when I was at Tulane as the recruiting coordinator were guys that were in the spring of their senior year of high school. And now that's just ancient. It's still possible, but that was certainly better because you were getting a more finished product to evaluate. And the player was both academically, socially, physically, was in a better position to make a decision on college and attending a university that's going to affect the next 50 years of their adult life. And so I really have a problem with the early recruiting of freshmen, sophomores. And I say that it's a total two-faced comment because we're right smack dab in the middle of it. We don't have any choice. And you can be somebody that stands on your soapbox and is against it. And then you're going to look up and, you know, the talent pool is severely thinned out. Now, I will give advice to parents that and high school coaches that talent always wins out. So if you're a sophomore and you're not being recruited right now, do not panic in any sense of the word, because one of the very best situations to be in, and parents really need to listen, is to be a really good player available later in the process. Because we all want good players, and your options at that time can just absolutely explode. Because, you know, we may have committed five sophomores, and especially in COVID, now when we get to go finally watch them play, you know, in their summer before their senior year, you may say, oh, wow, he's too good. He's never going to come to school. Or, wow, he hasn't really turned into the player that we thought he would be. Or the player may say, you know what, he finally gets to go visit TCU or meet me and say, you know, I changed my mind. I want to go somewhere else. So it's not good. There's a lot of shuffling. But to me, if you're a good player who works hard, you're a good student, you're always going to have options. Just wait until it's the right, you know, the right fit for you, whether that's in your sophomore year or whether that's in the spring of your senior year.
You know, one of the things that I think about quite a bit, because you hear this a lot, you guys go to showcases and, you know, there's a lot of players that show. One of the reasons I'm assuming that it's cost effective and a lot of good players are there. And you may be able to answer this and may not, but it kind of goes with what you just said, because sometimes you have to do something that you really don't want to do, but everybody else is doing it. And one of the reasons I bring it up is, you know, there's got to be some injuries that are occurring in the winter when kids are going to showcases, especially from the East Coast where I'm at in the Midwest. One of my thought processes was, well, if kids are getting hurt and it's not really good to go to a showcase at that time, especially pitchers possibly, but even position players may not be ready. The reason kids go to showcases, and I'm not against showcases, I just think they need to be placed in better times. And I may not know everything about this, but what happens is, college coaches go, so the players are going to go. Major league scouts go, so the players are going to go. What happens if Major League Baseball and the NCAA got together and picked different times that's better for players? So that way you're not eliminating showcases, but you're doing it at a time where it's a little bit more healthy for them.
Yeah, well, we've done that in college baseball. And I think some professional organizations have made their own kind of internal rules as to whether they're going to go out in the winter or not. We implemented a recruiting calendar that really had only been in effect for 1 year prior to COVID. I was a part of about 15 or 16 coaches across the country that we met. And one of the reasons we came up with it was to try to discourage what you're talking about. B, to give guys that I'm a big believer, and I know you've had this on your podcast before. I'm a big believer in multi-sport athletes, mm-hmm. to try and take some pressure off of them to say, well, shoot, if a college coach, Division I coach can't come watch me, then yeah, I'll play basketball or I'll wrestle or I'll play baseball. I mean, I'm sorry, football, or, you know, do something else, or God forbid, just take some time off and go on a vacation or just be with your family or you know, down south, not that this, I mean, hunt or fish, you know, if you just find something else to do, to get away from it. So we have a, if the calendar stays in place, we have a really restrictive one. It only allows 4 weeks of college, of evaluation between the middle of September and the middle of October. What happens though is, you know, just like anything else in life, you follow the money, and these large organizations, and they've done it. And, you know, I don't want to, they serve a great value, you know, PBR, Perfect Game. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly well run. They're worth the money in the right form. They do what they do a really good job of is video and disseminating information. And so they have showcases in these off time periods where Division I coaches, NCAA coaches can't be there, but junior colleges can, NAIA coaches can, professional scouts can, and then the video itself, we're going to watch it. And so they can sell that. And so it really just comes down to your own personal discipline as a player or as a parent to where you're going to say, yeah, we're going to continue to do this, or no, he's not doing it. Little Johnny is going to take some time off. And that's the pressures I know are tough. Everybody's, you know, chasing the opportunity to go play, you know, at the next level. Just remember, college baseball is the most underfunded sport in all the NCAA in terms of scholarship money, both male and female. And I have family sit in my office, and, you know, TCU, for example, is a private school that's real expensive, and, you know, they can't afford the difference between the scholarship we've offered and the cost of the school. And part of the reasoning they'll give us is the amount of money that they've spent and their savings to chase Johnny around. And of course, you know, my thing is, well, over the last 7 to 8 years, you've spent $40,000 chasing a $12,000 baseball scholarship, and that the economics of that don't make sense, but it is what it is. And again, but like you said, the showcases have great value, especially in the summertime. It allows the college coaches to see a huge number of players from all different parts of the country. Would we prefer to watch them play for their own team and be play for a championship? Yes. And a lot of those showcases do that, you know, the World Wood Bat stuff they're playing, and, you know, Perfect Game does a great job of having some incentives for those teams to win. So you do get to see them compete like that. And certainly locally, you know, for us in Texas, and, you know, if you're in South Carolina, when you're not at those showcases, you can bounce around and watch individual teams play, but it's changed. It's never going to be, you know, playing for your American Legion baseball team, 25 games. That's what I grew up with here in Maryland, Pennsylvania. That's still in existence, but it's never going to be like that again. So there's no use in boohooing it. We just have to make the best of it.
Well said, Coach. You go to these showcases, you've got a pretty good idea looking for because of your need. When you're putting your team together every year, and I know you're putting your team together, I'm sure a year in advance or a year and a half in advance.
Well, that's
I kind of like to get an idea. What are the things that you might be looking for in players, and what kind of turns you off sometimes about a player that you were looking at, but then you change your mind on them?
Well, let me first comment on what you said, going back to the early recruiting. You know, one of the beauties of the way it used to be, when you're recruiting prior to a senior year, is you literally could put a team together. You could, you're recruiting your needs, not your wants, back in those days. So, you know, you would say, well, hey, we're going to need a catcher, or we're going to need a shortstop, or we need two left-handed hitters. Well, you don't know 3 and 4 years out what your team's going to, wow. I mean, with the exception of catching, you know, everything else, I don't know who's going to hit third for us this year, let alone 4 years from now. Right. So really what you're doing, and this is, again, it's a bad thing and it's a horrible thing, but you're recruiting athletes. You look for athleticism. For us, we want guys that can, you know, play multiple positions. We like guys that can run. I mean, every coach likes that. Sure. If you're, you know, the old saying, you know, if you can really hit, they'll find a spot for you. That's definitely true. The problem is, if you're going to hang your hat as a player on the toughest thing to do in all of sports that we know, the good ones fail, you know, 6.5 to 7 times out of 10, if that's the only thing you're hanging your hat on, boy, that's a really tough way to survive in baseball these days with the level of pitching. So you need to be a good defender. You need to be athletic, be able to play multiple positions. And then you start talking about the things that, you know, you're talking about, which is, excuse me, the makeup of the player. You know, how does he handle himself? How does he handle adversity? How does he interact with his teammates? What do his, you know, coaches have to say about him? You know, how does he prepare before, you know, before a game? You know, we don't get to watch infield, outfield. They don't have very much infield, outfield anymore. So your chances are very limited. So for example, I tell, you know, in our camps, I'll tell players, you know, how hard, you know, like Joe DiMaggio, what did he say about, you know, when they ask him why he played so hard, this is before television. He said, well, you know, this may be the first and only time somebody in the stands has ever seen me play. So that's why I play hard. And yet it's really the same way now in this recruiting thing, because if you tell me, or the coach tells me, you're really fast, and for a right-handed hitter, the average time to first base is about four on a ground ball to shortstop, let's say, is about 4.3 seconds from contact to when he touches the base. Well, if you run 4.3, if you're supposed to be a 4.2 runner, which is an above average runner, and you hit three ground balls to shortstop and you run 4.6, 4.5, and 4.69, well, I don't care what the coach told me, you're a 4.55, 4.6 runner. You're a well below average runner for me. I don't get to watch you take infield and see how you move. I don't get to watch 30 games because we have to go to these showcases and you almost have to make decisions because the kids are making decisions so fast. And so, you know, if you don't run hard, if you don't play hard, then I can only go on what I see. And so, you know, those are the things you're looking for. And, you know, when you're around baseball and athletics long enough, you can read body language. You can see how, you know, a guy roots for his teammates or what his energy is like during the course of a game. And in the current world that we're in, I try to give the younger player a little more benefit of the doubt, because sometimes when you're 14 and 15, you don't know any better. And maybe you haven't been held to a high standard. So, but that just puts more pressure on your performance. So, you know, obviously we'll take a chance on a guy who's super talented to a point, hoping that once we get him in our culture and surrounded by, you know, what we stand for and older players that will hold him accountable, that he'll evolve into what we stand for. And certainly if he doesn't, then we'll have to remove that player from the program. But, you know, for the most part, we've been around long enough, especially with the organizations, and they've been so consistent in their leadership. You know, the guy who runs this organization or that organization, he knows me in our program. He knows Tim Corbin in his program. He knows Mike Bianco in Ole Miss, and he'll say, hey, this is a really good fit for you, or this is not. And we tend to trust a lot of that.
You know, I love what you said earlier on about multi-sport athletes, and obviously that helps, because now here you are. If you can recruit a guy who, you know, can play multiple positions, a big advantage. You know, talk to our players out there and parents. I know parents and players, they know that you've got to have a certain education, certain level of education to get into colleges. That's a known, I think, and, you know, and they people keep stressing the players how important education is, life in general. But explain, when you've got a young person who's really smart education wise, how does that translate onto the field? Because it's got to help.
Oh, 100%. You know, I mean, well, first and foremost, somebody who is doing well in school, that means they probably already have really good habits, right? So they're probably not oversleeping. They're probably showing up to class on time. They're probably sitting in the first three rows of the class. They're probably conscientious in how they do their work. They're probably interacting with the teacher, right? And those are all things that, you know, how you do anything is how you do everything. So, you know, those things don't change. And I've been saying this for 30 years. I've never had one player ever be underachieving in the classroom and overachieving on the baseball field. It has never happened, right? Now, I've had guys who aren't great students, but they give their best effort. So, you know, I won't name names, but we've had some guys come through our program that are in the big leagues right now that their very best effort was a 2.4 GPA. And I am 100% fine with that. I have no problem with that. But if your best effort's a 3.4 and we're making 2.4s all the time, That's the problem. And that'll eventually show up on a baseball field and it will get us beat. Because when you watch these regional, you watch college baseball, even a regular season game, they're so hard to win. The level of talent, and it's only going to get better. The major league draft being cut, the level of play in college baseball from this point moving forward is going to be played at a ridiculously high level. And so the talent level, the talent pool at really every level, but our level is what we're talking about. It's right here, man. And so what are the things other than the bounce of the ball or that flare that falls in that is the difference between winning and losing? It's between the ears. It's the ability to remain consistent. It's the ability to handle failure. It's the ability to take advantage of an opportunity. It's the ability to stay healthy and make good choices so you can be on the field more, right? So all of those things go to intelligence. And I'm not talking about book intelligence, mm-hmm. but I'm just talking about just the baseball IQ, the ability to be self-aware as to what's going on, what's the situation. And then you get into the mental game, which we are a huge believer of, in that you cannot be in control of your performance until you're in control of yourself. So you always hear say, well, man, the guys for Barry Bonds, man, the game really slows down for him. You know, what does that mean? Right. The best players, that's what they're like. They're never out of control. And that just means they're in control of themselves, that they don't panic and they play the game pitch to pitch. I'm kind of getting off topic here, but the guys who underachieve in the classroom, who aren't coachable, who have very low baseball IQ, I guess you'd call it, they flame out because the talent is only going to take you so far.
You know, and that's a good. What I want to mention is we're talking about young kids and something that we're seeing in the game that it, in some ways is changing. Especially in the Midwest, you know, we're playing a lot of games and games are great because you got to have game experience. But at the same time, how important is practice and sticking with the fundamentals of the game individually? And you just mentioned that we're going to get right into it. The mental game, I think it is so, you know, underestimated in some ways. We all talk about it a lot of ways. But what I want you to really talk about is when you talk about the mental game, you know, that's got to be created in practice and in great habits. Talk about how you kind of work that into everything you do.
Yeah. So, you know, you're preaching the gospel to me on practice. You know, I believe baseball at the amateur level is played too much and not practiced enough. And that's just a fact. And I'm not talking about lessons and hitting in a batting cage. I'm talking about practicing and learning how as a team within the team concept to win a baseball game. And that includes base running and team defense and all of those things. And that's a completely other topic than what you're talking about. But from a mental game standpoint, it's just simply that, you know, what is the definition of what we're trying to get out of the mental game? It's to be in your control. It's to be in control of yourself so that you can be in somewhat control of your performance. There are so many things in sports and life, but especially baseball, that we cannot control. What are the things we can control to give us the best chance to be successful and to be consistent, right? So we start that education from day one. That's Zoom has actually been awesome for that. We normally bring all of our incoming players in summer school in July prior to their fall of their freshman year. We weren't able to do that this year, so we had a lot of Zoom calls that and we introduced the culture of our program. We have Brian Kane, our peak performance coach, on the call with us. And then we just start that process that way. And then when they come to school, they get introduced to what I call the language of our program, the culture of our program. And then, you know, we practice, for example, you know, pitch to pitch routines every day, whether it be visualization in a bullpen. Coach Sarlos has our pitchers. They do what we call shadow bullpen. So you're going through, you know, everything that's happening on the field. You're doing that for an inning each day in the bullpen. Position players have to have a pitch-to-pitch routine at home plate during their at-bat. They have a defensive routine. And all that means is, it sounds hokey, I guess. All that means is, what's part of that routine? It's just simply having something consistent that you do that allows you to be in control of yourself, to control your heart rate, to control your mind, to make things very simple and clear-minded. And also to have something when the poop hits the fan, you have something to go to release that. Because we know, just like in life, things are going to go sideways. And it's the equation E plus R equals O, right? Event plus response equals the outcome. We cannot control the event. If, for example, the umpire just called a horrible pitch a strike, how are you going to respond to it? If you have a defined system to respond to it to get you back in the moment, then the outcome is going to be, it gives you a better chance for a positive outcome. If you lose control of yourself and now I'm worried about the umpire on the next pitch, well, you have no shot, right? So it's just the ability to get back to the middle and stay right here. That's what the best players do, and be in control of yourself. And so we practice those things every day. They're part of our batting practice. They're part of our cage routine. Because we really, you know, it's the saying that the Navy SEALs use, right? Like, you don't rise to the occasion. There is no such thing as a step up, right? That's a lie. It's false. You sink to your level of training, or you sink to your level of preparation. And so I'll never want to hear, you know, I hate the phrase, like, he really stepped up, you know, because if you really stepped up, then what the heck were you doing all the other times, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just about being in control of yourself. And that way, you know, tell our player, if you're a shortstop, a ground ball hit to me on a high school field in Chicago, a ground ball hit to me at TCU and in Fort Worth, Texas, and a ground ball hit to me in Yankee Stadium, for the most part, it's just a ground ball. That's all that it is. But what's different? Everything around, right? And so being able to control yourself in those settings allows us, in that super regional, when it's game three in the 16th inning at Texas, you know, against Texas A&M in front of 8,000 screaming people, to be in control of yourself, or in the College World Series, you know, on television or with 30,000 people in the stands. So we're just I'm such a believer in that. And it's not something you can talk about or put down on a piece of paper for one day. It's something that has to be a part of you and your practice on a daily basis.
No, I'm so glad you And I tell you, folks, I apologize. We're getting some feedback. You know, everything seems to begin when you're young, right? I mean, I learned Italian when I was between three and six without even opening a book, by just, you know, being with my parents and my grandparents. And you learn so much when you're young. And the reason I like that you brought up is because we need to start that process with young kids, right? And there was already pressure at games. I get it, right? Because you got parents and yelling, and you got, you know, coaches, and it's pressure. Kids trying to throw a strike. He's only 12 years old. But if we put him in some of those situations in practice, it'll be a little easier to transfer into the game. I mean, that's why I like what you said. I think it'll help coaches all over the world. The other part is, certain time in your career, you started getting into the mental game because you saw the importance of it, how critical it is to be successful as a team. What else have you learned that you wish you kind of knew early on that also translates into developing your club and getting them prepared for, you know, to be successful?
Mm-hmm. I would just say the main thing is baseball is a really simple game that's really, really hard to play. And I've said that, but I haven't really bought into it as a coach the way I should have earlier in my career. In other words, when I became a head coach at UNLV in the summer of 2001, I got consumed by the wins and losses, and they eventually did go next to my name. As an assistant coach, you know, they didn't go next to my name, and I was really close to the players, and I was the pitching coach. I was focused on the things I was in charge of. And then as a head coach, I really felt the weight, and still do, of the pressure of winning and losing. College baseball has become a really big thing, right? They're paying coaches a lot of money. You'll get fired. I mean, in the old days, you could stand over in the corner of the athletic department, you know, as long as you don't screw up in a major way, you could be the coach forever. You don't need a contract. You can make your $35,000 to $50,000 a year and be done with it. That's not the case anymore. So there's the pressure of winning and losing. And what you can't do is you can't pour that on to the players. And they already feel that, you know, when you're standing out, it's that, like the poem or the whatever the thing about the man in the arena, right? The guy who's out there standing on the mound, the guy who's fielding the ground ball, the guy who's in the box, that's where the, you know, pressure lies. And as a younger head coach, I was very bad at what I call personalizing the performance of the player. And I would literally, in my own mind, I'd like hold it against him that he struck out. And he wasn't trying to strike out. I tried not to yell at him about striking out, right? That's a result. That's not controlling a process. That's completely against the mental game and what it stands for. But my body language was very poor. And so I've tried for a very long time to be better at that. And I think I am. I'm still a work in progress because I am super competitive. But that's what you're talking about at the youth level, is when you go watch a Little League game and, you know, the kid, before he throws the pitch, he's looking in the stands. Or as soon as he hits the ball, you know, you got the coach yelling go, the parent yelling stop. I mean, there's just everybody screaming and yelling all the time. And little Johnny, you know, I don't care how old you are, you can hear your parents' voice, no matter how many people are there. And so if we could just, and this is what I've done a better job of, is just take a breath and just enjoy it for what it is. Hopefully COVID, in my case, COVID is definitely having that effect on me. Enjoy it for what it is. It's not going to last forever. These kids are going to spend way more life of their life not as a baseball player than they are as a baseball player. So just enjoy it. That doesn't mean hold them to a high standard on how hard they play and what kind of teammate they are. Don't hold them to a high standard on how many hits they get, because that's, you know, a lot of that is outside of their control. But for me, to answer your question, it would just be, if I could talk to myself 20 years ago, it would basically be, you know, lighten up, Alice. You know, these kids are playing hard. They want to do well. You need to be more supportive and they need to feel like you're behind them versus you don't need to be something else. They already have to overcome another obstacle in the game.
You know, and like you said, being an assistant, being a head coach, those are two different things. Mm. A lot of pressure once you're a head coach. So add on to that, to your young coaches out there that are just about to be a head coach. They just got the job. And they haven't started yet. Help them out a little bit, kind of cut the corners to maybe not make as many mistakes. They're going to make mistakes no matter what, but kind of cut those corners a little bit. What would you advise?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing you have to do, I'm a big believer, and this is a really popular buzzword today, but I'm just a huge believer in culture. And you have to define, that's what a leader's job is you, number one job of any leader in anything that you do is you have to define, implement, maintain a culture. You know, what do we stand for? What are we about? What are we going to hold ourselves accountable to, including me as the leader? And then everything else falls from that. You know, you don't need to be worried about bunt defense or, you know, a cut and relay if you don't have a culture that allows kids to a framework, a structure by which they can live in to have success. And so I think, you know, that's far and away the most important thing. And it can't be words on a wall. It can't be, you know, a T-shirt. It can't be something we type out and hand out one time. It's got to be short, succinct, and exactly, you know, here's what we're about. Mom, dad, parent, assistant coach, player, this is what we stand for. End of sentence. Now we can talk about the baseball stuff. And so that would be the first thing, far and away the first thing. The second thing is to, you know, I do believe you need to be yourself, but at the same time, you know, I can't coach like, Tim Corbin and I are very similar, but I can't be exactly like him, right? And we're always, you got to be who you are. I can't pretend to be Nick Saban if I'm Dabo Sweeney. I do believe in being a lifelong learner. And so you watch, if you want to be successful at something, find somebody that's already really good at it and watch what they do. I mean, not rocket science. So, I'm a big believer, you know, I read a lot. I've really gotten into podcasts. I study, you know, great coaches in different sports or great leaders, or military leaders, and just, you know, learn from those guys. But, you know, I'm getting off topic, but I think that for somebody that just takes over a program, culture is the thing I would start with.
You know, the other thing, what do you like in the dugout? What's your personality? And like you said, you got to be yourself in some ways, but you also learned because, you know, you were taking it hard when players weren't doing the things they should be doing. What do you like in the dugout, and how do you make some of those decisions that you got to make? Because there's some critical decisions to be made in a split second. Everybody thinks it's easy. Oh, I can make that decision, but you got 10 seconds sometimes or 12 seconds to make it. How does that process work?
Well, I mean, I've been doing it 30 years, so experience is a great teacher. I've had success because I've failed, right? I think that's maybe Michael Jordan or something like that. Yeah. So I've screwed it up in every possible way, I think. I hope I can't screw it up worse than I have lately, or in the last 30 years. But I have a lot of people say to me, you know, wow, you're pretty stoic in the dugout. You don't really, you know, you're so calm. And I really just try to stand there with my arms crossed and try to be, you know, reward success, try to be positive. I'm basically, it's kind of like I tell them, well, if you really knew what was going on, it's like a duck, right? You know, the duck looks calm on top of the water, but underneath it's going crazy. So, you know, I've been around long enough. So when you're talking about the decisions, you've already played these scenarios out in your mind, whether it be before the game or, you know, if we're in the first inning, I'm already thinking about the third. Or if we're in the fifth, you know, and I'm watching the starting pitcher and I'm watching the lineup, right? He's about to run out of gas, or this is where I know he hits a wall. What are the matchups in the bullpen? Certainly I have great, and have always had amazing assistant coaches that I've tried to empower, and they have a huge voice in what we do. So they're a part of that. We have those conversations and those are constantly ongoing, throughout the course of a game. But I've, you know, tried to play the game out in my mind beforehand, which is part of the mental game, right? Everything happens twice, once in your mind and once physically. That's why visualization is a huge part of what we do. But in terms of decisions, I'm thinking of those things ahead of time. And if I'm asking the players to be like this, then I can't be like this. And, we want them to have positive energy in the dugout. We want them to root for their teammates, but I don't want cheerleaders. I love football, but football is played once a week, and you can't take that mentality into a baseball game, you know, on a nightly basis. So baseball is more right here, and that's where I try to stay.
I love that. And first, out there, especially parents that are coaching, hopefully you took that advice. You know, you brought up assistant coaches, and we're coming close to the end, Coach, but you brought up assistant coaches, and I've heard you talk about, you know, loyalty, and I've heard you talk about knowledge is important, you know, and all that. And there's a couple other things you mentioned, but here's what I'm curious about with your assistant coaches. You want guys and gals that are going to be also internally in an office with you, sometimes challenge you a little bit, or maybe say, why don't we do, in other words, not yes people only.
Oh, it's incredibly important. That's the only way you're going to grow and learn. I mean, when I do these podcasts, one of the things I always get asked is like, all right, who are your mentors, or who have you learned from? Well, some of the people I've learned the most from are the people that worked with me, you know, assistant coaches. I hate to use the word for me. We're all working together. We just all happen to have different job descriptions. But yeah, if you could put a camera in the coach's office or in our meeting room, and we're planning practice or talking about players, all right, it's pretty epic, you know, because there's a lot of great conversation, and I encourage it. I tell, you know, one of my rules for our staff is I only want one voice to each area of responsibility. So for example, I don't want the pitching coach talking to a hitter about his swing. I don't want the hitting coach talking to a pitcher about his breaking ball. But when we are in that office and it's just us, if the hitting coach sees something in the pitcher that he thinks can be better, say it, and we can argue about it. Or if we're discussing bunt defense, or how did you guys do this when you were at, you know, this school, or what did you do this in professional baseball, and we can argue it, we can, you know, break it all down. But then when we walk out that door, we've made a decision on how we're going to handle it, and we're a united front. And so, yeah, I mean, one of the best hires that I've ever been a part of is my associate head coach, a guy named Bill Mosiello, is literally the best baseball man that I've ever been around at any level. It's not close. And He's our third base coach. He runs the offense. We discuss the offense, but you know, in 2014, we came back to beat Pepperdine in game three of a super regional, and we scored two runs in the top of the ninth inning. The go ahead run was on a squeeze play, and I didn't put it on. He put it on. And, you know, we've talked about it. I love the play in the right scenario. When I'm sitting in the, you know, I'm standing in the dugout and the crowd's going crazy and we're trying to get to the World Series and it gets to a 1-0 pitch. And the first thing I thought of, the combination was perfect. I was like, squeeze play right here. And I just watched him put it on and we executed it. And then we got him out in the ninth inning and went to Omaha. So I think, you know, you have to have people that you trust like that. But you have to empower them and they have to have a voice. But ultimately at the same time, somebody's got to eventually make a decision. Right. And so as an assistant coach, it's easy to sit over across the desk and pop off and say this and say that and make suggestions. And I've been there and I've done that. And I want to hear that as the head coach, but it's way different to sit on the other side and make the decision. And that's, you know, that only comes with experience and sitting in that chair and making those tough calls.
Yeah, I want to thank you for mentioning Mosiello, DiMaggio, you know, good Italian. So we talk about Italians a lot on the show, but a little preference for Italians. You know, the other thing is an assistant coach, a lot of assistant coaches, you know, they have dreams. I want to be head coaches. Not all of them. Some of them I've known assistants to be, you know, assistants for 25 years. What's your advice there when you are an assistant, but yet you also have that goal of being a head coach, but you don't want to, you know, overdo it by, you know, constantly contacting people? I mean, what's your advice to get to the next level?
Yeah. So my first piece of advice would be you just take care of that. You know, your job is to make sure you take care of whatever you're in charge of. So be where your feet are. If you're supposed to pitch and recruit, or if you're supposed to coach the infielders and fix the field, then the infielders need to be coached like crazy and the field needs to look awesome. End of sentence. And then, you know, when you work hard, you're a good person, you attach yourself to a winner. I believe that's really important, is to be around winning baseball and successful people, successful programs, then you're going to get the job. It's eventually going to find you. If you always have your head sticking up looking for the next job and you're not doing a good job with what you have, then it's probably not going to work out, you know, very, very well, or you're not going to be prepared, or certainly the person you're working for is going to, he's going to notice that. And I've only had that happen to me really one time in my career as a head coach. And I want coaches that desire to be head coaches. I want them to be upwardly mobile. I want them to be like that, because that when Randy Mazey gets the head coaching job at West Virginia, or Todd Whitting gets the head coaching job at University of Houston, or Tony Vitello gets the head coaching job at Tennessee, another Italian.
Yes.
you know, that only helps me hire the next guy. Yeah, because, yeah. And you know, those guys know that I'm going to promote them. I'm going to give them responsibility. I'm going to hold them accountable. But just work, man. And all that stuff will take care of itself. One thing I do wish, and this is a good piece of advice that I wish I would have done, as a young coach, and really my whole career, I'm doing a better job of it now, but it doesn't serve me as much now, is I would have journaled, right? So I started my career in the fall of 1992 at Clemson University as the bottom guy on the rung. Bill Wilhelm was the head coach. He had been there for 37 years. Jack Leggett was the top assistant. Randy Mazey was the next guy. And then myself. And I wish I had written down, this is what happened in practice today. This is what I thought went really well today. This is what I thought, like, Coach Wilhelm's crazy doing this today, right? You know, because you learn things that you'll do and you learn things you won't do. And what I would give for a journal of all of those days from my time at Clemson, from my time at Tulane as a head coach at UNLV, all the way through the 18 years at TCU. And I can't tell young coaches enough, when you're working for somebody, just once a week or every day, if you can, just write some things down, because you're going to forget them. If you can go back to that, man, you'll really, what a great resource that's going to be when you do get your head coaching job and you are moving forward.
Man, great advice. Coach, a couple things, just four things. One, coaching-wise, what have you seen in coaching in general that's changed for the good, where that coaches are doing better now than maybe we weren't doing as well back then?
I think in college baseball, it's running comprehensive programs, right? So back in the day, you could, you know, chew tobacco, hold a fungo, do a little bit of recruiting and coach the baseball team, you know, and now you can't do that. Not in Division I baseball. You have to be a leader. You have to be able to have a view from 36,000 feet on the entire program, from coaching the team to recruiting, to team building, to fundraising, to interaction with alumni, you know, dealing with administration, dealing with other sports, dealing with the media. I mean, it's basically every job that a major league organization has rolled into one, period. I mean, you know, you're the traveling secretary, you know, you're everything. And so, you know, that's why I'm, you know, this is no disrespect to professional baseball. Professional baseball and college baseball, they're the same sport, but a completely different game when it comes to the coaching side. And what I mean by that is you can think about it. How many former, especially major league players, came to college baseball as coaches and have had great success? There's not very many. It's what makes Kirk Sarlos really good. You know, he's one of the very few. Tony Gwynn obviously was a good one, but there have been so many that have got in it. And within a couple of years, they're like, there's no chance I want to be a part of this, right? Because when you're a baseball guy, you want to do baseball. And in college baseball, there are times of the year where 30% of what you do is actually baseball. It's everything else that you better be good at. So that's, you know, if compared to 20 years ago, there are so many great program builders, and you still have to be a good baseball person because that'll get exposed too. You can't just be good at the other stuff and not be a good baseball person unless you hire really strong baseball people to do that for you. But that's the biggest difference.
Folks, I could be real selfish, and I can go for two more hours and ask so many good, you know, hopefully good questions. But lastly, and we'll end it on this. This is a little bit outside the box in some ways. But if you were, you know, and I ask this to a lot of people because I'm big on the development of youth players long term, you know, really get, you know, teaching coaches at the younger levels, make, you know, helping them out, because a lot of them, you know, are volunteers. Matter of fact, our volunteers are the largest baseball organization, even though they're not organized, in the world. Sure. You can add college, high school, and professional coaching. It doesn't even come close to the number of volunteers. And it's so critical because that's what is going to keep a kid in the game longer. And people say, well, they drop out at 12 and 13 because of this reason, that reason. Well, a lot of it is, and statistics have shown, because they don't have fun anymore. And they don't enjoy the game. Their coach, they don't like as much. It really, you know, we see all that. So my question would be, if you were commissioner of baseball and you had anything you could do at the youth levels, travel teams, whatever it may be, what changes would you make to make the game better? You know, it's a broad picture.
Yeah.
You know, if you were, you know, one of the coaches even, and you were going to make the game better with that young team, what would you like to see different? I'll give you an example. I personally would, you know, love to have a league where kids threw fastballs only to start with, you know, at 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. So they understood that you can get guys out with a fastball, different type of fastballs, 2-seam, 4-seam, whatever it may be, just to develop their pitching, because in the long run, that might help them. You know, the Japanese have done that for years and shown major success with that. And that's maybe one of the things I would change, you know, but what do you think? What should happen?
Yeah, I mean, I love, you know, that's that, what a great idea. I hadn't even thought about it in that form, but, the first thing that comes to my mind is I hate to say play less, but they just got a team practice. And obviously to have a team practice and have it be good with time on task and functional, then the coach has to know how to do that. And, you know, I don't expect a guy who's working a full-time job and then volunteering three or four, you know, two or three nights a week to maybe know that. But if you're going to take on the responsibility of coaching young people, then you should in a sport, then you should probably invest some time in learning that. And I think, you know, you can go visit other, you know, you can go visit college programs. I don't know any college coach, not one time has someone emailed or called me and said, hey, coach, can I come watch practice today to learn about this and ask you some questions? Not once have we ever not said, come on, right? I don't know any coach that would ever say you can't come do that and or answer or get some help. Say, hey, I just got a job coaching a team full of 13, 12-year-olds. What are some things I need to do in my practice? Just go ask. And every, you know, every coach out there, every college coach is going to help you do that. But I would, you know, I'm just a big believer. I don't think that they need to spend a lot of time on coaching hitting because kids hit all the time on their own. They have private lessons and doing all these other things, but just really trying to teach the game itself. You know, what does it mean when there's a runner at second base and nobody out? What is your job at home plate? You know, right. And, or, you know, where to be on the field, you know, they, people, Buck Showalter, who's a really good friend of mine, one of the greatest baseball minds ever, talks about how do you watch a baseball game? Well, an amateur person is going to watch where the ball is. Someone who really understands baseball, look away from the baseball. What's happening? And so when the ball is in the right field corner, where's the left fielder supposed to be? It's all of those things that I think that players lack. And I believe now on the flip side, talent, the talent level of baseball players today is it's elite. It's never been better. They throw harder. They hit the ball farther. They're more athletic. They're in better shape. They run faster, but their skill has never been worse. Right. And skill is something you can impact. And that's just repetition and learning the game over time. And so I love your idea where there's more action. And I'll say one of the greatest baseball fields I've ever seen in my life was in Texas, and somebody had like triple windscreened behind home plate from dugout to dugout, and the parents and the fans had to sit in the outfield.
Yes.
I love that because, and I'm not bashing parents, I'm one too, but let them play, let them enjoy the game. You know, when the game's over and they just want to get an ice cream and a freaking candy bar, awesome. And the questions to ask are, did you have fun? If you did or didn't, why or why not? What did you do to help your team win today? Not get four hits. Did you, you know, hey, I saw when Billy struck out, you put your arm around him and said, get him next time. Awesome. That's what we're looking for, you know? And it's those qualities that I think are the ones that, you know, translate into the rest of life. So we could keep going with this deal, and absolutely, I'd love to get back on your show. We could do like four installations, but
well, hopefully you'll come back. Just love to have you back again. Talk more. Yeah. You know, and I want to mention, you know, I think that's a great idea about the parents. You're putting them out there just to let them relax. You know, my parents came in from Europe, and when I was a little kid, they always would stay away at a distance. You know, they must have known something. They didn't want to put pressure on me. You know, they knew that if I saw them all the time or I heard them all the time, there'd be a lot of pressure. The other thing is, and I know it's a whole story, practice organization, we haven't gotten into that, but that might be a whole show in itself because how important it is, because that's really where kids don't enjoy that, you know, because like you said, some volunteers really don't understand and it's not their fault, but they do need to get educated a little bit. And that is, how do I run a fun practice? So that way the skill level continues. And when you have good skill level, you have some success, and success means fun. And we all know that. So, and we look, and the big thing I think you said, and you said it twice, and we keep saying in our show, and I want to encourage our people all over the world to understand this really well. And that is playing games, nothing wrong with it. Just make sure that you practice more than you play. So, you know, like in Cuba, they might play 100 games, you know, or Latin America, but they practice 200 times. Japan, same thing. Why are they so successful? So we can see that. In the U.S., we have 26 million amateur players. We're going to get some pretty good players, obviously. We got great coaches at the college, high school level, travel sometimes, depends, you know, on the level. But, you know, you've got a point where if you look at other countries, I look at Canada, Australia, not a lot of players, but what do? They practice a lot. And yes, game experience is important. So I thought you hit a grand slam with that.
Thanks so much. I mean, I've always kind of felt that way, but there were times about 15 years ago, Augie Garrido is the legend in our sport. And there was a time where college baseball was pushing for more games. Like, let's get back to 80 games. And Augie was always one of the coaches that stood out and said, we don't know. No. And I was a young coach, like, what's he talking about, that old man? Right. And then we became super, super close. And he said, Jim, amateur players need practice. We need more practice time with them. And he didn't say fewer games, but you know, playing four games a week and practicing, you know, two or three times a week is much better than playing six times a week and not ever practicing. That's where I think minor league baseball, and they're starting to figure it out, where they miss out. And so, Augie was, he was one of the best for a million reasons, and that was simply one of them.
Absolutely. Coach, a thrill, an honor to have you on the show, man. I listen to you talk a lot of times, and I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. Thank you very much, man.
You got it. Thanks for having me, Peter.
All right. That is Coach Jim Schlossnagel. I said it right that time. I got it. Man, I took it slow, no pressure. Folks, thank you very much to Coach. Thanks very much to Brian Kroc, our producer with the Lineup Media Group. Don't forget, go to baseballoutsidethebox.com for the audio. Go to YouTube, Peter Caliendo, subscribe. Help us out, get the show out. Thank you, everybody, in the U.S. and around the world and on Facebook. Anytime we can help you, caliendo19@gmail.com. Email me anytime. Stay safe. God bless you. Stay healthy. And we'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.